There's been an enormous amount of change in business in the last 18 months, perhaps more than I've seen in my entire business lifetime up till now. And I'm keen to examine what some of these changes might be and what opportunities these might present. Why am I qualified to do this? Well, I am a businessman, a coach, an entrepreneur, an investor. I've set up more than 30 companies. I float a business on the stock market, led hostile takeovers. And I guess it's not always been glamorous, but I've worked at the coalface of Business Britain. But why should you take my word for it? I've prepared a list of 10 questions, and I'm going to ask the same 10 questions to 6 different people from completely disparate areas. Some people from the arts, billionaires, economists, comedians, and I'm asking them a whole range of questions from how they think business life will be in post-Brexit, post-COVID Britain, to the advice that they might give their children and what they think about climate change. And I look forward to exploring those conversations. Today, my guest is Liz Martins, who is senior economist at HSBC, and I'd like to welcome you to this this podcast. As you know, we're asking 6 people from completely disparate parts of life the same 10 questions about the Britain 2.0, the sort of post-COVID, post-Brexit Britain. And of all the people I'm speaking to, you're the one who's the only economist. You're the only one who really knows what she's talking about. So I'm looking forward to discussing these questions and hearing your thoughts and views. So welcome. Good morning. Let's look at life through your lens, Liz. So what opportunities and threats do you think that Britain and the economy has as a result of COVID virtually ending and Brexit? How do you see the world? How do you see the UK?
Yeah, so I think we've just come out of kind of a double shock, haven't we, as the UK? 2 major changes, and of course our government ploughed on with the decision to leave the EU, even though, you know, a lot of people said they could have delayed it through 2020. So actually, we've come into 2021 and the future with these 2 big changes. So let's maybe take them one by one. COVID-19 fundamentally has been a supply shock to the economy. If you shut down large parts of the economy, so it's not producing goods and services, nobody's investing, nobody's consuming, you know, that is going to fundamentally diminish supply in the economy. It shouldn't be a surprise to any of us that we've come out of it and there just isn't as much to go around as there used to be. And you see this in all recessions, you know, in the global financial crisis, you know, they stopped investing, they stopped even making bricks for building because the housing markets took such a tumble. So it takes a while to adjust.
And we shouldn't be surprised that economies like supertankers take 18 miles to turn around and stop and start again.
Absolutely. And what happened in the first lockdown to the UK economy and the global economy was really extraordinary and unprecedented. You know, we've obviously heard those words a lot in the last couple of years, but it really was. And as you say, it takes a while to adjust back from that. Now, economists talked a lot about a V-shaped recovery, and really that is what has materialized in demand, but the supply side takes longer, and that's why we're seeing a lot of sort of supply issues now, and a lot of shortages and constraints, and that's pervading right across different sectors of the economy.
But let's drill down into that. What opportunities does that offer, and what threats? Well, we've seen some of the threats, and those of us have been queuing up trying to put diesel in our cars recently. But what are the opportunities and the threats as you see it going forward into the medium term?
What you've got is a supply-demand imbalance, and what the economic textbooks tell us is that when that happens, prices go up. That will attract new producers into the market, new suppliers, and you know, we're all relying on human ingenuity to meet these supply challenges. So, you know, what are we short of? What do we need? For example, one of the big issues at the moment is the global supply chain, getting goods around the world, not just to the UK. The US is having big problems as well. So what might be the answer to that? I think, you know, things like 3D printing can be a big winner there. So you're not relying on those big supply chains change, maybe moving some of that supply chain. So it's not the other side of the world. Maybe it's nearer to home. Maybe that might be one way in which, you know, people can respond to these challenges, because ultimately opportunities are all about seeing a problem and thinking creatively about where the answer lies. And I think, you know, ultimately human ingenuity will win out, and there will be a change to that. I guess the next challenge then is Brexit, and that has had a real genuine impact. If we look at the UK's imports and exports, they've not really recovered from their pandemic lows. If we look across to the Eurozone, they've had a much stronger recovery in trade. So if we look at the divergence in the performance, you know, you have to conclude we've all suffered from the pandemic, we've all suffered from these global supply chain issues. The difference has to be Brexit. So we haven't yet recovered from that.
I read an article that you wrote last week where you were talking about the export curve, and it looked pretty grim in terms of recovery. Is that something that we should worry about, or is it just going to be slow to get going again?
Well, I think... I think we should be worried about it, to be honest. I think we've made things harder to trade with our largest trading partner. Now, obviously, the UK's long-term plan is to do deals with other parts of the world and diversify so that we're trading with Asia and the US more. But as you say, the same issue again, it takes a long time to make these big structural changes. For now, I think it is something to worry about. You know, the UK's competitive advantage has been eroded, and it is causing real issues in the economy.
Well, that leads on to my second question, really, Liz, is what will our trading relationship be like with the rest of the world? What will our trading relationship be like with China, with Europe, with perhaps the US? Do we need a trading agreement with the US? Import tariffs don't seem too dreadful. What's your view?
They're not too dreadful, and we do a lot of trade, of course, with the US already. But I definitely think that, you know, the more deals we do, we've done one with Australia, which is good news. The more deals we do, you know, the more that will diversify demand for British goods and services, and that will be positive. You know, it will take a lot to offset, you know, any lost access to the European market, but it may be that over time pragmatism prevails in our relationship with Europe as well, and maybe, you know, negotiations are still going on as we speak. That's more to do with the Northern Ireland Protocol, but it's not to say that over time some of these obstacles couldn't be eased, and I certainly hope that.
Do you not think common sense will prevail? After all, you know, it's inconceivable that we don't want to, that the Germans and French and the rest of the Eurozone don't want to sell us their cars and washing machines, and we want to buy them. So will common sense not prevail eventually? It's interesting, I used to live in Switzerland, and they seem to have quite an interesting relationship with the EU, and sat quite comfortably in the middle, where they embraced Europe without necessarily being in Europe.
Yeah, but they have a lot of different deals, and they do basically have free movement with Europe, and that's where the UK's red line was drawn. So if you want easy access for trade, free movement is the price that the European Union has set, and that's the price that the UK hasn't been prepared to pay. In terms of do the French and Germans want to sell us, you know, cars and Prosecco? Absolutely, of course they do. But unfortunately, that's not the problem. The problem is we want to sell them things as well. And that's where the obstacles currently are coming in a little bit. And that's a shame.
And if I can push you a little bit, if you're looking into your crystal ball, how do you think this will pan out? How do you think that this will end? What will be the compromise?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think as I think common sense and pragmatism does usually prevail in these matters. Whether that means the UK giving a little on immigration, I mean, we've already started to see that in the current supply crisis. We've seen, you know, the government issuing some or trying to issue some visas to truck drivers and so on. So maybe it involves a little bit of the UK giving on that side. And generally, you know, as time passes and if obstacles are causing problems for both sides, then talks will be held to try and remove them. But it might just take some time.
I'm glad to hear you say that. And talking about our trading relationship with the rest of the world, what is our relationship with China? How's that panning out? You know, we've seen us blaming China for the pandemic, you know, whether it was started in laboratory or whether it didn't. We're concerned that China might invade Taiwan. You know, how's that going to pan out? We seem to have outsourced a lot of manufacturing to China, and now we're moaning about the energy that they're using. You know,
yeah.
There's some unresolved business there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult one because we can't ignore the behemoth, economic behemoth that is China. It's a huge player in the global economy, increasingly so. It is a good customer for, you know, the West's particularly services exports as well. And there will be opportunities for UK companies there. The political wind seems to be changing all the time on that front. And so that will be difficult for companies, I think, to try and navigate. But ultimately it's a huge player in the global economy, and that shouldn't be ignored. At the moment, China seems to be undergoing a bit of a growth slowdown, which historically, you know, a big economy globally slowing down should be bad news for the rest of the world. In this case, if it does reduce a little bit demand for commodities and that kind of thing, it might actually relieve some of the supply pressures in the global economy, which might even end up being positive.
That is interesting. And from this sort of melee of information that you digest on a daily basis, Liz, what kind of trends do you think have emerged that will be here to stay? What kind of differences in the way that we live and do business are you sort of seeing?
I think, you know, in the post-pandemic world, we're obviously doing a lot more remotely. We're doing a lot more online. And I think we're seeing that in across different sectors. Now, I think the human desire to interact, be sociable, be in the same room, that remains undimmed for sure. But there are a lot of efficiencies that have been kind of accelerated in the pandemic. And I think that, you know, and it's not just the you know, people at the cutting edge of technology. It's your grandma as well, who's gone out and realized that she can do her shopping online as well. And people have been kind of pushed into doing much more online, using less cash, and all those kind of things, and that stuff, I think, is definitely here to stay.
That's interesting. So what I think you're saying is, not putting words into your mouth, is that there aren't necessarily any new trends. These are sort of old trends that were happening anyway that have sped up.
Yeah.
And the pandemic and Brexit have forced us to sort of just go down that route more quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, video conferencing not always existed, but it's existed for a long time. And yet the pandemic forced us to do so. I think what's going to be really interesting, what's going to be a test, is business travel. Now, in theory, now we have Zoom and other platforms like that. There's no need for anyone to ever get on a plane for business reasons again. And if you combine that technology with the climate change goals that many countries have adopted, you know, we could see a real drop in that. And yet, many people in business will tell you face-to-face contact is invaluable and irreplaceable. And actually, we may see a bounce on those grounds. And certainly from my perspective, sorry, as an economist, I'm starting to see more and more face-to-face bookings, and I'm very glad that I am.
Do you know, I'm with the latter. I think that Zoom is a blunt instrument, and while it's a useful way of communicating simple information, it lacks any of the nuances, and humans are gregarious people, and I think we're seeing the pendulum swing back now. I'd be an investor in airlines. I think they've been oversold, and any well-funded airlines, I think, have rebounded or are rebounding, and I'd certainly be an investor in that as one of the sectors that I'm quite bullish about. And certainly in my office, I'm seeing the hustlers, the salespeople, the kind of young people have been frustrated, and there's this kind of human gene that we're designed to be gregarious. And I've noticed I think they're coming back to work, and socializing is almost overheating. I'm always trying to put the brake on a little bit. But let's look back at the cost of all of this now. Who's going to pay this? You know, we're talking about a £400 billion bill for the lockdown, and still growing, you know, with new requests for subsidies of companies using high levels of energy. Who's going to pay this bill? Who's going to pay for the ongoing requirement of the NHS and the whole care system?
Yeah, I mean, that's the £400 billion question, I suppose. The UK public debt has risen by 20% of GDP just in the 2 years since the pandemic. It's a huge amount of money. There's kind of two schools of thought. One is that as long as interest rates remain relatively low and investors believe in the UK and are prepared to buy that debt and invest in it, then the UK doesn't need to immediately panic and try to pay it down. It's not like you having a personal loan that's eating into your income and you know you're not expecting a pay rise to cover it. you know, a country, a government debt is slightly different. So some people would argue we shouldn't worry. We should capitalise on interest rates being relatively low, although actually, as I speak, they're going up quite rapidly in the markets, at least, and deal with that, you know, at a later point, or hope that the economic growth takes care of it. If you are not of that school of thought, then you think we need some action to reduce the deficit, reduce the national debt pile. And I think that's probably where our Chancellor sits, Rishi Sunak, more so actually than a lot of others in the developed world. We don't see other countries immediately rushing to put taxes up, but we have seen that here in the UK. So we've seen Rishi Sunak announce corporation tax going up actually very steeply, 6 percentage points from 19 to 25%. That kicks in 2023. And then companies also face their national insurance costs going up as well in 2022. And that, of course, also applies to employees. So that's the new health and social care levy.
It is. And it worries me that even a, you know, teenage school child could see that that's probably not the wisest way to, you know, to punish the employees and the job creators. You know, seems to be the wrong way to raise taxes.
I think it's really challenging. We've come out of this pandemic, and probably thanks to government intervention, it's gone better than many people would have predicted. You know, we have had a V-shaped recovery in demand. But just as we've got to this point where we think, oh, we seem to have survived it, you know, they said it couldn't be done. It felt at times like the end of the world. And we've come out the other side, and suddenly your input costs are going up, your commodity costs, your staff wage bill is going up. You can't get your orders in from wherever you've ordered from. And here's the government saying, actually, and the tax bill's going up as well. It is tough for
companies. Let's go down that rabbit hole. Let's look at that. It seems to me that the, you know, the two words of inflation and higher interest rates are looming and scaring a lot of business owners who are thinking of making investment decisions. Where do you think we're going to end up with those two items?
I think that the inflation threat is more real than it's been probably since the global financial crisis, and maybe before that. And that is because we have a genuine supply hit, which we've talked about already, in conjunction with a pretty solid demand picture. So it's almost inevitable. We're seeing wages go up, and the risk is that you get a spiral there. So I go to my boss and I say, my cost of living's going up, my gas bill's going up, I need a pay rise. I get a pay rise, but then my boss says, well, now my costs have gone up, so I need to put my prices up. And then, you know, the cost of living goes up again. So then you get a bit of a spiral. Now, most economists, including us, think that this current cycle will be contained, and that inflation will peak somewhere in the region of 4% in the UK. It might stay there for a while, but it will come back down again. But certainly, you know, there are risks, I think, that it goes higher, sticks around for longer. And for the Bank of England, it is their job to try and make sure that doesn't happen, or try to make sure that inflation, on average, gets down to 2% again. And that's why they're talking about raising interest rates, possibly as soon as the end of this year.
That, just to give you an insight into my world, which is consultancy world and recruitment world, the evidence that I'm seeing is that we are seeing scary amounts of inflation, wage rises of 15 to 20% in some circumstances, counter offers being accepted at obscenely high increases. And when you don't have the commodity, as you say, there are only three ways that you can solve this issue. You can either steal a member of staff for somebody else, train somebody up, or relax the visa rules where you're bringing in people for key roles. And given that, you know, England was kind of built on immigration, really, do you think that that pressure will help the government to perhaps relax some of the visa rules?
I mean, first of all, that's so interesting to hear what you're seeing. You know, it's almost like maybe the official data aren't even capturing that level of wage pressure and the acuteness of the tightness in the labour market. But I think you're absolutely right. It is something we're seeing across different sectors. Is migration going to be the answer? It might normally be, But in this case, actually, it's not just the UK that has this labour shortage. You know, particularly the sector in the UK where it is most acute and well documented is HGV drivers. That is something that is true across Europe.
It is. 80,000 shortfall in Germany, 60,000 in France, 15,000 in Italy. That's not a Brexit issue.
It's not a Brexit issue. You know, maybe exacerbated by Brexit, but you can only say that if you've got a queue of HGV drivers who want to come in, but they can't. Now, the evidence so far is that that's not the case. You know, I think the government has opened up some emergency visas, and actually they found that applications have fallen short because, yeah, lorry drivers can stay in their own country and get a job in the same sector. Now, that's telling me that perhaps pay growth in the UK has further to go, because at some point, you offer a wage that will attract people over here or into the industry from another industry, perhaps. But, you know, a lot of different things have happened to the labour market. People have become inactive. People have decided to leave the labour market completely. But also new jobs have been created in new industries. And I remember, you've seen the Russell T Davies series Years and Years, and he paints a vision of the future where there's been a financial crash and the only job anyone can get is delivering things on a bike. And that's kind of what's happened here, is that suddenly there's all these jobs, big distribution centres, people bicycling your groceries over to you and your dinner over to you all the time. And a lot of jobs have been created there, which means there's less capacity to take other roles.
That's true. I want to push you on a slightly different area, Liz. And my other guests have kind of smoothed over this a little bit, or kicked the can down the hill a little bit. How are we going to fund the NHS going forward? We're all living longer. Our use of healthcare, I think it was Bevan who said, you know, Britain has an insatiable appetite for free healthcare. And it's not just the money, is it? It's the efficiency of the monolith of that we call the NHS and all the care homes that are associated with that. How are we going to solve that?
Well, I'm tempted to go down the road of your other guests and try to avoid this question.
No, I'm not letting you do that.
It's an incredibly hard question. The NHS is so precious to the British people, so valued, so, you know, so treasured, and yet it's so expensive, and it's so, you know, and it's still got major problems. You know, there are so many problems in so many areas of it. And if you talk to some people, they'd say that's because of the fundamental design is no longer appropriate because of, as you say, the demographic factors, and some would say it's underfunded. But if you want more funding, then where's that going to come from? Is it going to come from more borrowing? Well, as we've talked about, we've already seen debt go up a lot. Or is it going to come from more taxation? Now, this government is already telling us that taxation will be at its highest since the Second World War, with the tax rises that have already been announced. And then you have people like the Institute for Fiscal Studies who produced a report saying, actually, the health and social care levy will probably need to double, which is the national insurance rise on both employees and employers, if you're going to cover that expense. So it is a really difficult question. I think some people will see an increased role for the private sector in healthcare in the UK, but I think there'll be a lot of political resistance to that because, as I say, it is absolutely treasured, particularly after the pandemic.
It is. It leads into my next question, though, which is about trust, really, and it's about business trust with the government. You know, in the years that I've, the companies that I've started, I've always felt in Britain that there's you can get good title, there's a kind of legal system that you can trust, and you can sort of trust the government and the BBC. I'm not sure that's the case anymore. And other business investors that I'm talking to are concerned that the job creators, the business risk takers, will be punished and penalised, and it's not healthy to have distrust between the business sector and the government. What's your kind of view on that? You know, we've seen an enormous amount of control, sort of control that society hasn't seen before, about lockdown, and we're not quite sure what's going to happen with vaccine passports and what sort of things are going to be enforced. They're different times, aren't they?
They are different times, and there's two parts of that. I mean, there's one which is the pandemic, which obviously required governments worldwide to intervene massively into the private sector in a way that, you know, they haven't done for a long time, if ever. And with that with that intervention, you get you get some kind of involvement that maybe, you know, companies maybe wouldn't welcome. But as well as that, I suppose there's the amount of data that we now have, the ability to capture, and that enables some you know, knowledge of the private sector that maybe used to be more private. So I think there's a lot of things that have changed, and maybe businesses won't be happy with that ultimately.
And that leads on to leadership then of the future. What kind of business leaders do you think will thrive in this kind of new market, where certainly decision making has been sped up in the same way? You know, people have had to make very quick decisions about what they're going to do, what they're going to do to their business model. Some business models have changed for the better. It's forced some companies to go online. High streets are changing their whole face. But what sort of people, what sort of entrepreneurs and business leaders will thrive in this new Britain that we're living in?
I'm not sure so much has changed in terms of the people who will thrive. I mean, there are new skills, right? There are new skills that will stand young people and the leaders of tomorrow in good stead. Coding is the obvious one.
Yeah, supercomputing.
These kind of things. Obviously, that'll stand you in good stead. But what it takes to be a leader, I think, probably hasn't changed. That's in human nature. And those are all those kind of qualities of leadership, empathy and drive and ambition and boldness and all that stuff. I mean, I don't think any of that's really changed.
Okay, that's one of the things that does seem to have changed is the way that we're doing business more and more often remotely. And we talked earlier about, I think Zoom's a blunt instrument. You don't see all the nuances, you don't feel the pride or sense of concern perhaps that you might pick up in a face-to-face meeting when you're looking at people's body language in a different way. Do you think that's here to stay? Is it a drag on productivity, or is it a great cost saving as we're all downsizing our offices?
So I think there's two points to be made here. And the first is about competitiveness. You know, you might be having a nice Zoom conversation with your customers, but your competitor might have gone the extra mile, flown in, taken that customer out to dinner, had a face-to-face meeting, built a relationship, and you're stuck at home on Zoom and you think everything's going well, but you're left behind. And I think there's probably a good, you know, everybody always says, you know, business is about relationships. And I think, you know, as I agree with you that there's a limit to the relationship you can build over Zoom. And I think people like to interact. People like to be together. In terms of productivity and remote working, I think this is interesting. I think people have worked incredibly hard from home in the pandemic. I know I have. If I have a lot of work to do, I actually choose to stay home, not because I want to, because I'm going to be more productive at home, because, you know, I cut out the commuting and the, you know, wandering off to get a coffee and the chatting. There's so much chatting in the office. Now, the difficult thing to quantify is what that chat generates. Now, it may stop me from doing what I was doing and getting through my to-do list and mean I have to work later, but if it generates a really good idea, then that is what you can't quantify, and it's what you can't get on Zoom. So that's why I think a lot of employers are trying to get people back, because of the belief that actually when you put people together, particularly people who aren't in the same team, so they're not going to be on the same Zoom call, they're not going to necessarily be cross-pollinating kind of ideas, it's people that you might not necessarily normally talk to, but you've just bumped into them in the lifts. That kind of thing is what you can't quantify, but when it generates good ideas is invaluable.
The creativity that comes from those random meetings. No, yeah. I agree with you. I also think that there's that employers are scrabbling around now trying to work out a different way of managing people who are home working, and they, people have different, you've talked about how disciplined you are. There are people who aren't disciplined. They're sitting at home watching, you know, Loose Women and Cash in the Attic and Judge Judy, or worse.
Lucky them.
Or worse. And I think that there are new trends of management emerging. You know, do you have a dedicated workplace at home? Or are you living in a flat share with other people where it's very difficult to do that? Do you have a desk at home? Do you not have a desk? Are you going to check in with people when you're starting or finishing work? And there are people that will suit people that have got more discipline, and there are people that need to be in a more disciplined environment who will perhaps come to the office. I also am slightly concerned that there's this kind of out of sight, out of mind issue. And, you know, we've made a lot of progress about the kind of gender equality. And if there is a trend that women are working from home a bit more to pick up the kids or being carers in some ways. I'm slightly concerned that this out of sight, out of mind might mean that they're missing out on opportunities that other people are getting because they're in your face and you know, you can see them in the office. Are you concerned about that?
I think that's interesting. I think that kind of goes to the point I was making before about the competitiveness of in-person versus being on Zoom. On the other hand, women in business have always said that they've felt left out of part of the, you know, the action. So, you know, the men might go off to the pub after work. I'm not saying women can't go to the pub too, but historically, you know, that has been a documented trend. So, you know, being at home, you know, the advantages for many women in the situation that you're talking about might outweigh the negatives, but I think you just have to be very careful that you're not missing out on that interaction and conversations aren't going on behind your back that you're missing. But I also think it's not just women that like working from home. I think, you know, a lot of men have been able to reconnect with their families and spend time with their families and enjoyed that. And actually, I think, you know, insofar as working from home will stay with us and be an increasing part of the landscape, I think it will be both men and women that benefit from that.
Okay, just coming back to your economic background now and the way that you understand that money, the way the money runs through the system and how governments control that. Let's just look at crypto. Can I ask you about cryptocurrencies for a little while? I've noticed that I looked this morning actually before we met, the list of countries that are kind of either banning, under no circumstances can you have any cryptocurrency, or there are cryptocurrency with restrictions, and some pretty big countries on that, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, China, on that list. Is cryptocurrency a new global thing that we should envelop, or is it the emperor's new clothes and will it be shut down and should we just forget all about it?
I think for me, I would divide it into things like, Bitcoin is the most famous, you know, these kind of things, which are kind of operating like an asset class, like an investment opportunity. And we're seeing huge volatility in those markets, which I think is what makes some governments quite nervous of them. They also are not very green. They have a lot of carbon emissions associated with them.
They do.
So those things, I think, mean they have problems. And then I think you have countries like El Salvador, which has announced that Bitcoin is now a nationally accepted currency, except nobody's actually really using it. That's one thing. And I think there are still loads of questions, most notably the carbon emissions one and the volatility.
Are you more concerned about the volatility and the carbon emissions than the sort of government control or governments, the feeling that they'll be losing control of their economy if they don't control the currency?
I think that's probably is a big worry for governments. On the other hand, what they can do, and this is the second point I was going to come on to, is issue their own central bank digital currency. So the one that's being mooted for the UK might be called Britcoin, for example. And that actually gives central banks, governments, some control over it while still increasing the efficiencies of financial transactions, and also allows more financial kind of penetration across the system. So I think, you know, Bitcoin and those kind of volatile markets is one thing, and then central bank digital currencies I think definitely are.
It is, but that sort of defeats the object a little bit though, doesn't it? Because Bitcoin is supposed to be a global thing, whereas if we've just got Britcoin and that's our own little, you know, it's like going to Thomas Cook and changing it before you go abroad again, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose the financial technology would make it a lot easier than queuing for Thomas Cook, which I certainly remember, and coming away with your envelope and your notes. You know, I think it would make it considerably easier to make those transactions, but I see what you're saying. You'd still have an exchange rate fundamentally, yeah.
And we talked about the sort of carbon effects of crypto. Let's just forget the economy for a second, or forget COVID or Brexit. Will climate change finish us all off?
So now we're getting to the really depressing, as if we haven't been depressing enough already. But I'm not a climate change expert, but I have I've read a bit about it. I read a book called The Uninhabitable Earth, of which the first sentence is, "It is worse, much worse than you think." And actually, if you read through some of the projections of what can happen, it is.
I've not read that book. Is the conclusion that it's irreversible? Is it too late?
No.
Can we make some changes?
It's not too late, but the changes that are currently being talked about by government probably don't go far enough. And actually, we've just written a report on this ahead of COP26 in the UK, and it's all about who bears the cost, because that's the ultimate question. Of course, the government would like the private sector to bear the cost. The private sector would like the government to bear the cost. Households don't want to be taxed anymore. You know, to genuinely reduce carbon emissions, the most effective thing you do is whack a great tax on them. And then we all think twice about taking our car out and putting the heating on and, you know, taking a flight.
And that forces new technology to be invented.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that stuff is really hard at this juncture because we've just had a pandemic. We've already got tax rises. We've already got inflation. You know, for the government to come out and say, we're going to announce this massive tax on business and households as well, or actually we're going to borrow another $400 billion. I think the Office of Budget Responsibility said it would cost the government £344 billion over 30 years to take a quarter of the share of the cost of reaching net zero by 2050. So this is why I guess you get...
And the consequences are quite severe, really. You know, they're talking about a half a metre rise in sea levels in the next 50 years, which is probably in your lifetime, perhaps not in mine, maybe in mine, who knows. You know, that's something that would affect us and our children and our relatives.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the UK... is better placed than many countries in the sense that our climate is quite moderate already. We will have more extreme climate events. We will have sort of flooding and so on. But, you know, as well as that, I think, you know, parts of the earth will become uninhabitable and then you'll get climate refugees. And that could be one way in which countries like the UK could be affected.
That's interesting. So just distilling all of these opportunities and threats that we've talked about and the life that you're living now, we're all living in this kind of post-Brexit, post-COVID economy, what advice would you give to young people or your children entering the world of business now? What kind of sage seeds would you plant?
I think it has to be about taking the best of the old and the new. It has to be taking advantage of the technologies and the efficiencies and the remote working and all of that, and knowing how to code and how to navigate fintech and financial transactions and all of that stuff. But also being able, and this is something young people are not very good at the moment, pick up the phone and speak to somebody. Because, you know, picking up the phone, having an old-fashioned phone call goes a long way. Or go to a real meeting and don't be afraid of real-life human interaction because, you know, as we've said, touched on a few times in this conversation, that is at the heart of business and relationships, and that is what I think is really key.
That's such an interesting point you've made, and I hadn't thought about it before. We had somebody in the office yesterday that we had to talk to about being late, and they said, do you want me to leave then? No, we don't want you to leave. We just want you to sort out your timekeeping. And it was interesting that they were in their late teens, their whole world had been about avoiding confrontation. So in this kind of social media digital world, you can walk away pretty easily,
yeah.
You know, and for the first time, there'd been some confrontation where somebody had challenged them and said, look, you need to come in on time. And their instant reaction was, should I leave then? Should I run away?
Anything to end this conversation.
Yes. Whereas actually, no, it was a straightforward conversation. Yeah. And it was like, what can you do to come in on time? You need to get an earlier train or whatever it is, you know, everything will be fine.
Yeah.
So that resonates.
Yeah.
But Liz Martins, from Senior Economist from HSBC, thank you very much.
Thank you.